This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The killing of a human rights lawyer and two other men brought hundreds to the streets of Nairobi on Monday to protest what they call police death squads that kill those who challenge the government. The police chief says the three police officers arrested in the case are rogues and rejects the claims of death squads.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details next. Also, Americans are celebrating the July 4th holiday today, the nation's 240th birthday. And the World Health Organization says three cases of Zika virus disease have been reported in Guinea-Bissau. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: last week's killing of a human rights lawyer and two other men brought hundreds of protesters to the streets of Nairobi today. And they've demonstrated against what they call police death squads who kill those who challenge the government. The police chief says the three rogue police officers have been arrested in the case, and he rejects the claims of death squads. VOA's Jill Craig reports from the scene of the protests.
Here in Nairobi, a few hundred human rights activists have gathered to march and protest the deaths of Willie Kimani, a human rights lawyer, his client, Joseph Atmawinda, a motorcycle taxi operator, and Joseph Moruri, their taxi driver. The three men disappeared on June 23rd following a court hearing in which Kimani was defending his client against police charges following a traffic stop gone wrong. The three are believed to have been taken to an administrative police compound. On Friday, the three missing men's bodies were found in a river about 70 kilometers from Nairobi. Boniface Mwangi is a Kenyan human rights activist.
There's been a habit by the Kenyan government when they do not agree with someone or when they have a problem with someone, instead of actually taking them through their proper government channels, they kill them. I think there's also fear among the professionals, because in the past they've been killing a poor taxi driver, a suspected gangster or terrorist, but they've gone beyond that and now they're killing professionals for doing their job.
Some of the protesters carried coffins from Uhuru Park to the Supreme Court that say stop extrajudicial killings. Others carry buckets of red paint to symbolize bloodshed. Many of the protesters are wearing T-shirts that say stop police executions. The activists say they've come here for justice, full accountability, and they are demanding the resignation of the Deputy Inspector General of the Administrative Police, as well as the Inspector General of Police. They're also demanding an inquiry into all extrajudicial killings in Kenya. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
In Nigeria, attacks against oil pipelines and facilities appear to have resumed after a lull at the end of last month. A militant group, the Niger Delta Avengers, is calling for greater development in the oil-producing south and has vowed to reduce Nigeria's oil production to zero unless its demands are met. Chigadua has more from Abuja.
After nearly a seven-year hiatus, militancy in the Niger Delta is back in full force. A gang known as the Niger Delta Avengers says it attacked five oil installations in the past 3 days. The group announced Sunday on Twitter that its members hit three oil pipelines owned by the Nigerian State Oil Company and two facilities owned by Chevron. Chevron and the Nigerian oil company confirmed the attacks. Later, the Avengers' Twitter account went offline. It was not clear if that meant the account had been blocked or if the group removed it. Attacks by the Avengers this year have brought Nigeria's oil production to a near 20-year low, costing as much as 600,000 barrels of oil per day. The Nigerian government relies on crude for 70% of its revenue, and the country is sinking into a recession. President Muhammadu Buhari has said he will not be intimidated, but also said he wants dialogue. The The government said it negotiated a truce last month, but these fresh attacks cast further doubt on reports of talks.
There is no practical demonstration. No, there is no putting into action a statement. We had expected him before now to start the process of discussion by calling stakeholders for a meeting personally as the president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, like his predecessors did, but he hasn't done that.
That's Eric Omare, the spokesman of the highly influential Ijaw Youth Council in the Delta. The council helped to mediate talks between the government and the MEND militant group back in 2009. That amnesty deal gave ex-militants money, job training, and even work guarding pipelines in exchange for peace. But Buhari cut much of the funding for the program off this year, and the avengers emerged. Grievances in the region remain much the same. The area remains impoverished and polluted. The avengers say that unless that begins to change, the attacks on oil companies will continue. Chika Odua for VOA News, Abuja.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Uhib in Washington. Twelve past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Hundreds of protesters in Nairobi demonstrated today against what they call police death squads who kill those who challenge the government. In Nigeria, attacks against oil pipelines and facilities appear to have resumed after a lull at the end of last month. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Italian authorities are weighing frightening allegations made by a convicted people smuggler that some migrants are being killed so their organs can be harvested. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments from Rome. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the case.
Nuruddin Wahab Rebi Atta was arrested by Italian police in 2014. He's the first foreigner given witness protection by Italian authorities after revealing details of a very elaborate criminal network that's supposedly trafficking drugs, arms, and human beings from Africa to Europe. Now, he himself was a smuggler, and he has claimed that migrants unable to pay for their journeys across the Mediterranean are being sold by traffickers to organ traffickers in Egypt. This seems quite amazing, but he's claimed that those who are unable to pay for their voyages are being sold for 15,000 euros to groups who are mostly Egyptians who are involved in removing and selling these organs.
Now, is there any way to substantiate these claims?
No, in fact, one of the prosecutors involved in this particular investigation said today there is no way to validate these claims, and authorities here are cautious about the claims, but also obviously very interested, particularly because Atta is seen as a fairly reliable source, and it appears that his evidence has helped Italian police smash an alleged trafficking network today. They have arrested 23 around the country, and they've issued arrest warrants for another 15 people. So his claims are considered to be worth taken seriously, but the authorities have been unable to completely validate what he's saying.
So if he's been in custody since 2014 and he's making these claims now, does that mean that this was allegedly going on at least in 2014, or is this something that he says is new?
Well, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison in February for his role in this elaborate network. It's not clear whether that was what prompted him to cooperate with police. He has suggested, according to the documents leaked by police today, he has suggested that he decided to cooperate because he was concerned about the number of deaths he was seeing in the sea. And he referred in particular to the 2013 tragedy at Lampedusa, where 360 people drowned in that tragedy. So it's not clear why he has decided to collaborate. It seems that he has been cooperating with authorities for quite some time. So we're just waiting for a little bit more information about that. But certainly there has been a lengthy investigation conducted by police that has revealed cells, smuggling cells in North Africa, Rome, Palermo and Agrigento in Sicily, as well as other locations in Europe. And incidentally, more than €520,000 and more than $25,000 in cash was recovered from what is said to be the Rome cell in this operation, which was headquartered in a perfume store near Rome's central station.
Josephine, in another matter, there was the court hearing today in Palermo, Sicily, regarding another Eritrean man who was recently apprehended and accused of being a major human smuggler. What is the latest on his case?
This man is accused of being Medani Yedego Mared, the Eritrean who was extradited to Italy after an elaborate international operation involving Britain's National Crime Agency, Sudanese police and Italian police. At a preliminary court hearing in Palermo today, his defence lawyer, Michele Calantropo, presented testimony from two refugees now living in Sweden who claim that the arrested man is not Mared and that the Italians have captured the wrong man. Today's hearing was a preliminary appearance before the court. This case will continue and we're expected to be back in court on July 21. And if it's true, it's going to be terribly embarrassing for Italian prosecutors as well as the British police and British diplomats who've been involved in this case.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. The 21st International AIDS Conference opens in Durban July 18th. HIV experts, people living with the virus and others will gather to review the progress made and challenges that remain in the battle against AIDS. This will be the second time the South African East Coast city has hosted the event. Durban first held the International AIDS Conference in 2000, a time when AIDS deniers disrupted the supply of essential medicine to HIV-infected people. In this report, Darren Taylor reflects on what happened in Durban 16 years ago and why it's considered a turning point in the epidemic.
The International Convention Center in Durban, July 9th, 2000. The HIV-AIDS epidemic is ravaging South Africa, the hardest hit country in the world. Thousands are dying. Then President Thabo Mbeki takes the stage at the opening of the 13th International AIDS Conference. 12,000 delegates, including scientists, healthcare workers, and people living with HIV, are hoping he'll say something that could point the way towards easing the crisis. But in one sentence, Mr. Mbeki challenges the efficacy of scientifically proven weapons against the spread of the disease.
One of the questions I've asked is, are safe sex, condoms, and antiretroviral drugs a sufficient response to the health catastrophes we face?
Health editor for South Africa's Mail and Guardian newspaper, Mia Malan, was at the conference. She remembers the audience's reaction to Mr. Mbeki's statements.
I think people were angry. They were angry that Mbeki was using such a huge, important platform to defiantly reinforce these dangerous and unscientific and misguided views.
At the time, the South African president refused to give antiretroviral or ARV drugs to HIV-infected people, calling the medicines toxic. Yet science had proven them to help protect people with HIV against opportunistic infections that could kill them. Mr. Mbeki also doubted that HIV caused AIDS. One of the conference's co-chairs of AIDS 2000 remembers it well.
So he was basically challenging the entire scientific world about a well-established fact. It led to a demand for antiretroviral, which was quite dramatic and quite successful in many ways.
Jerry Kuvadia, one of South Africa's top HIV scientists, is now Professor of Pediatrics and Child Health at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Co-director of the Center for AIDS Research in Africa, Professor Salim Karim, was the conference's other co-chair. He says the president's questioning of the link between HIV and AIDS resulted in many South Africans not practicing safe sex, thus inflaming the virus's spread.
He could not have given a worse speech. He was quoting figures that were out of date. He was drawing conclusions that were completely out of date and actually wrong.
Karim says Mr. Mbeki's views at the conference ironically united the AIDS sector to fight for infected people's right to ARVs.
It created a common purpose, and it created a social movement that was really a juggernaut. He became the common enemy. And when people left the conference, everybody was singing the same words. We have to provide treatment to everybody. It is not acceptable that some people will die just because they cannot afford this treatment.
But after the meeting in 2000, Mr. Mbeki continued his intransigence. According to Harvard University research, 330,000 people died in South Africa between 2000 and 2005 because they couldn't get ARVs. Kuvadia says the Mbeki administration's stance on ARVs will forever be one of the greatest tragedies in the country's history.
It really stands out in a way that just cannot, and not just cannot, should not ever, ever be repeated. It was disastrous, disastrous for the reputation of this country, disastrous for our democracy, in fact.
Kuvadia adds that AIDS 2000 had a phenomenal impact on raising opposition to Mr. Mbeki's policy on ARVs. It would be a long fight, but AIDS activists eventually forced him, through the courts, to start providing the life-saving drugs in South Africa. Today, the country has the biggest ARV program in the world, giving the medicines to more than 3 million people. Karim says the meeting 16 years ago had further positive implications.
It led to the Global Fund being created. You know, the Global Fund is a major mechanism for global solidarity where rich countries contribute money for treatment for AIDS patients in poor countries.
He also partly credits the 2000 conference for inspiring the United States government to establish the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, in 2004. Karim says both initiatives have saved millions of lives, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Americans are celebrating the July 4th holiday today, the nation's 240th anniversary of declaring independence from Britain. President Barack Obama is hosting military families for a barbecue at the White House. The annual fireworks display is scheduled for tonight, but rain is in the forecast. The key to the holiday is just down the street from the White House at the National Archives Building. It is the home of the Declaration of Independence that was drafted by Thomas Jefferson and adopted by Congress on July 4th, 1776. The document says all men are created equal. However, African Americans did not get their freedom in 1776. As a result, some experts say that Independence Day has a different meaning for them. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi asked Gerald Early, professor of African American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis, to explain why.
July 4th has always been a holiday that African Americans feel a little bit estranged or alienated from, because we are celebrating the birth of the nation, but African Americans did not get their freedom when the nation declared its independence. And it wasn't, in fact, for some many, many years after that before they got their freedom. So in many respects, African Americans don't feel quite the same patriotic feeling about the nation that other Americans feel on this particular day. I think that part of it lies in the fact that the founding of this country was actually the founding of a white country. I mean, it was a kind of white nationalism that created the United States, and black people were not considered really a part of the founding of the country or the fabric of the country. And I think that's always stayed in the historical memory of African Americans, which is why they feel a little bit estranged from this day. People feel as though looking at African Americans feel that looking at the founding fathers, many of whom owned slaves and few of whom gave up their slaves as a result of the Declaration of Independence.
But as slavery was abolished in 1865, did that change African Americans' feeling about that day of 4th of July?
Well, I think it changed African Americans' feelings about the Constitution because then the Constitution added the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which not only gave African Americans their freedom, but gave them their citizenship, their right to vote, and so forth. So I think African Americans felt differently about the Constitution than they did about the original document, which in Article 4, Section 2 actually said, you know, actually had a fugitive slave law. So African Americans felt the Constitution had been corrected. And I think African Americans felt more like they were part of the nation. But I think at that point, African Americans felt that after all the years of segregation and Jim Crow and the like, that the nation refused to live up to its promise of those amendments and to the promise that was in the Constitution. And so I think there was still a certain sense of feeling somewhat removed from the United States in that respect. African Americans have fought in this country's wars, have been, by and large, very loyal citizens to this country and the like, and feel very committed to this country because they feel very much as though they were instrumental in building and shaping the country. So I think on that level, African Americans feel a certain kind of patriotism to the country, but it's tempered by the fact of the slaveholding past of the country and that the country has taken such a long time to fulfill the promises of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
It's documented that at least 5,000 African-American men fought for the Continental Army against the British. Does that give African-Americans a reason to feel they had contributed to that independence of the United States?
Yeah, I think many African-Americans feel as though they did contribute to the Revolutionary War and fighting for the American side. Of course, it should be said that African Americans fought for the British side as well because the British promised freedom if they would fight on their side. So black Americans fought on both sides. Black Americans contributed to the American Revolutionary War, but ultimately slavery was not abolished as a result.
That was Professor of African American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis, speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. The World Health Organization says three cases of Zika virus disease have been reported in Guinea-Bissau. However, it is not clear whether it is the same strain of the virus that's found in the Americas and the Western Pacific. There is a strain of Zika that's common and widespread in Africa. The WHO reported that the new strain of Zika was found recently in Cape Verde. The virus is spread by mosquitoes and through sex. However, the WHO says there is no evidence. At this time, it can be transmitted by breastfeeding. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Keith Holmes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews? Analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.